Thank you very much. Well, seems to be a pretty long agenda for this evening. I hope everybody had a good night's sleep last night. You may be up pretty late tonight. Everybody feel like working tonight? I mean that actually fairly concretely, because I enjoy talking, but I also enjoy conversation too. So at some point, let me warn you, I'm going to precipitate, or at least I'm going to try to precipitate some real back and forth conversation on one or two topics that intrigues me tremendously, especially nowadays. Well, anyway, start the ball rolling. Wendy, when she rode over, said, "Don, well, you always like to have some sort of a central theme to peg on." And so most of us, of course, have heard 20 or 30 times your story about meeting Baba. But some of the people have never heard it, and obviously everything that happens in one's own personal relationship with Bob has its own eternal springtime. So let me go way back into the very end of World War II. And I was one of these struggling young Sufis out in the Bay Area who had been initiated by Murshid Martin, and would go back and forth on the streetcars, which never seemed to run on time, and wonder why God and the hierarchy didn't arrange a poor struggling aspirant's life a little bit more readily to make getting on with this internal path a bit easier. On one of these occasions, she said, "Don, I'm calling a special meeting on Saturday next weekend for something that's extremely important." And he has an extraordinary sense of smell, that dog does. He really loves odors. He's taking a little more inventory now. So we went over.
You missed that. Especially perfume.
I thought it was French cheese. I thought I was probably still pretty well loaded with that.
Shoe leather, anything.
Well, we all congregated over in Merced Martin's living room, and she said to us that ever since Anayat Khan had dropped his body in 1928, that, as was the tradition in the Sufi order, and an awful lot of history in back of that, but we just don't have time for it this evening. She was looking then for her successor as her murshid, as her teacher, the position that Anayat Khan had filled, and that she had come to the conclusion that she had found that individual, that his name was Mayor Baba, but he lived in India, was born of Parsi parentage, and I can't remember whether she explained what Parsis were, we knew it, but at any rate, Mayor Baba of India, she told us at that point, she was quite certain, was the individual who would become her spiritual guide for the future. And she said that she had already been in touch with him in India and had asked him if she would accept her as his murid, as his student, and if he would also accept her order, that she was giving us 2 weeks to make up our mind whether we would follow her as Mayor Baba's guide, as Mayor Baba is our guide, and that on I think 2 or 3 days later in the following week, that there would be 3 of Baba's very close followers who would come to the Sufi school in Fairfax and give us a good deal of the background of Mayor Baba. We went to Fairfax, the old Sufi summer school, and Murshid Martin sat on the dais with Elizabeth Patterson, Irina Machabelli, and Mildred Kyle, And Irina Machiavelli gave us a very impassioned address on Mayor Bava's self, his stature, his background, her association with him. And we had an opportunity after that to chat a little bit, and then we had a little bit over a week to go back to our respective homes and think it all through and decide whether we would come back and tell Mercy to Martin, yes, we would follow her under Mayor Bava's guidance, or no, we had reservations and would not. There was very little literature, actually, at that point on Mayor Bava. We had a little blue folder book called something about the universe. Can't remember the exact title anymore. Do you remember it, Ned?
Universal Message?
Yes. No, it wasn't the Universal Message. It had some of the very, very early diagrams of evolution and involution in it. Maybe it'll come back to me in a little bit. And I think there were three volumes of what was at that time the five-volume Indian edition of the Discourses. We may have had at that point 50 selections of little messages, a little paperback, but that was the entire literature. So we all delved into this as rapidly as we could and became aware of the fact that this was an individual who had taken a vow of silence, which was a little upsetting to a Westerner's mind, and read some of the things that he said. We can't beat around bushes, and so I just have to be honest with you. This isn't a success story at this point. I rapidly ran across a number of things that disturbed me quite considerably. I mean, why an individual in this busy day and age should take a vow of silence and try to have a considerable impact upon the world's problems was really beyond me. And so I floundered around in that for quite some days, as a matter of fact, plus a few other pet problems. And I think two or three days before the time limit was up, set by Mercy to Martin, I thought it was high time for me to go back over and lay my heart on the table, and she could make mincemeat of it or whatever she wanted to. But it was necessary to at least start leveling a bit on the subject. So with great trepidation, because I had an enormous respect and confidence and great sense of the integrity of Mercy to Martin, and to be coming back with reservations that represented a questioning, an implication of questioning of her judgment, was very difficult for me. Incidentally, can you hear way back over there? If I start getting too thoughtful and drifting down lower and lower into my chest, why, just say a little louder, please. But usually my voice is fairly caring. At any rate, I went back over to Mercy Martin's study and sat in the chair where I usually sat in front of her as a mere read, and finally forced myself to bring out these points. And she listened very patiently, I suppose, for 10 or 15 minutes. And then finally she met all of my problems with just one very simple statement. She said, "Don, how can the drop possibly try to measure the ocean?" Well, this is actually quite an old classic statement from ancient mysticism. She may have leveled it at me before, but I really realized that this was the heart of the matter. And yet at the same time, I also realized that at that moment, I was sort of stuck with the problem of the drop really trying to measure the ocean. How else could I get through this problem that she had posed to me? So, at any rate, it was very obvious that she was not going to sit down and go into a great, tedious, intellectual dissection of this whole matter. Bless her heart, I mean, a great mystic doesn't concern themselves with that sort of an effort. So I had to go back, and I spent about 48 more hours with myself. And I finally decided that actually the drop could not measure the ocean. The only thing that was possible was my intrinsic faith in my spiritual guide, Mercy to Martin. And if I had complete faith in her, then automatically there was absolutely no question of my questioning her own judgment. She was ready, after all of her experience, wisdom, and life, a magnificent life, beautifully lived, if she felt that this man was not just, let's say, the normal successor, but she had made it very clear, a magnificent successor to her own beloved Murshid Inayat Khan, whom she loved and revered. This was so obvious. Then what could I do but accept her judgment? So I did it just simply on that basis. I didn't put the blame on her, but when the 2 weeks was up, I simply said, no, I accept him too. I knew inside of myself that there was a whole little storehouse of things that I had to sort out and digest. But nevertheless, the basic decision was, here was my spiritual teacher in whom I had utmost confidence, who had made her decision, had placed her spiritual ongoing and future in the hands of someone called Mayor Baba. And this was enough for me. Nevertheless, I had to do some housekeeping, some tidying up. It took 7 long years. This was, as I say, just at the end of World War II. And we all got busy, and we'd get a letter about once a week, Murshid Martin would, from someone in Baba's entourage that he was coming over, and then it was postponed, and then he was coming, and then it was postponed. Finally, Murshid Martin became ill. She contracted a cancer of, I think it was a lymph gland in the back, and finally passed away from that. So she never got to meet Mayor Baba, her chosen teacher. It was sad, but she had given herself. From the time that she made this announcement, she had me blow up the charts on involution and evolution and the universe and creation, and she taught from those to the end of her life. Absolutely total devotion. You know, isn't that an extraordinary thing when you stop to think of it? This woman, who was a young woman, had been initiated by one of the great mystics of that time, Inayat Khan. Enormous charisma, charm, magneticism, and totally devoted to him. When her new spiritual teacher came, whom she recognized, then with absolutely no sense of negating or downgrading Inayat Khan, then gave her total devotion to Mayor Baba. It was a fantastic thing for me to see. So 7 years went along, and I often look back over those 7 years and think of the fact that it was an enormous personal inner experience in retrospect now to see the fashion in which Mayor Baba took me through successive crises, learning positions, situations in my own personal life, and brought up these various different reservations that I had had about different things that puzzled me. Let's be honest, the silence, that really deeply upset me. One of the first things that began to happen to me was that all of the old ladies up in the Sufi school in Fairfax began to get ill, and the manager of the property got ill too. And here was Stevens in about his mid-20s, who was the only person with any energy around. So I got saddled not only with my own job at work, but trying to keep that institution running and nurses and doctors flowing in and out. So I was getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night and absolutely dead on the rail most of the time. And then all of a sudden, once when I was sitting in my office one day and puzzling over a processing report, I found myself just sitting very, very quietly with my feet together, my hand in my lap, and being silent. And my assistant Steve Shutt came in and started talking to me about what the chromic acid bath was doing to the aluminum outside, and I just felt I didn't want to talk about the darn thing, and so I didn't say anything to him. And he looked sort of a little puzzled at me and went on back out. I guess Stevens is in a glower today or something of that sort. And suddenly this idea of silence sprang up in my mind. I thought, well, gee whiz, I wonder if there's anything to do with psychic energy or things that need doing and silence. Well, I don't pretend that this is why the Avatar maintains silence, but, you know, from personal experience, a little tiny bit of a breakthrough, the barrier cracked through. And I actually found that when I was absolutely, totally exhausted, physically, emotionally, psychically, that if I were just silent for a while, somewhere or another, the old Stevens batteries managed to start recharging, and I'd get back up to a point where I could at least begin to function a little bit. Well, as I say, this undoubtedly has nothing to do with the rules and regulations of avatarhood, but nevertheless, it represented a little bit of personal insight into the question of silence, and I began to think of Bob as silence with a little bit more interest and respect. For 7 solid years, various different types of things went on. Some of the things that I questioned in relation to Baba solved themselves totally. Some of them, let's say, went into neutral. And then finally, when in 1952, the word came over, Baba's bought his tickets, he's bringing 4 Mondali with him, and he's arriving in New York on such and such a date, came through. I found, looking inside of myself, that this whole background of housekeeping that obviously had been done had actually been pretty well cleaned up. This was one of my first experiences of the manner in which the Avatar fulfills this job, how he knows what's going on inside of you, what has to be done, and how he goes about cleaning up the things that have to be sorted out. You know, this is the fantastic thing about this business of an avatar, the individual who's in charge of creation. The fact is, he really does know. And the second thing is that he is so much more perfect a workman in charge of a job and a problem than you and I have ever seen, that his standards are absolutely astonishing. So it's been a while afterwards that I realized the thoroughness of the job that he did in that 7 years period of time. But very, very, very typical. So here we get to, let's say, a day in the springtime of 1952, and the word has gone out that Mayor Baba, as a matter of fact, you know, we didn't run around screaming J Baba or Jai Baba and Avatar Mayor Baba. There were only a very small, limited number of people, a few of the Mondali, that Baba had said anything to at that time about avatarhood and being the avatar. It was, you know, here is a great, certainly a perfect master. But all during the early part of his ministration, Baba did not particularly claim to be this or that or the other thing. And it was rather late in his ministration that he came out rather flat-footedly and just simply said, I'm the avatar. I must say this quite honestly. So, at any rate, here is going to come this great spiritually developed individual by the name of Mayor Baba. And after 7 years, I really felt that at least I was up to date within myself, and I felt happy about the vow that I had made. Incidentally, he made us all take a new vow, which was somewhat modified from what we had previously taken. And one of the difficult parts of it was absolute honesty, which set us all a bit into a tizzy. But that's another story, too. So, he was arriving in New York, was going to go down to Myrtle Beach, where that magnificent person who many of you have had Baba's grace to know, Elizabeth Patterson, had built the property at Myrtle Beach to receive him. Then he was planning to come on out to California to another property that had been devoted to him at Ojai, called Marymount, just a little north of Los Angeles. And if we had the ability, we'd go out to Myrtle Beach to see him there and then see him again in Ojai. And because I was employed in a business, you know, where at least I felt you had to make very careful plans about vacations and let your bosses know well in advance, and you had substitutes, and I was in research chemistry and one of the 7 octopi of international oil at that time. You had to be very sure that there were people to back you up in the laboratory to be sure things didn't boil over. I didn't think that I could get to Myrtle Beach, but I was certainly going to see him in California. Well, bless him. Midway across the continent, of course, there's an accident and breaks a leg. Well, that's sort of startling in relation to the avatar. Why didn't he see around the corner and see the car that was coming in the wrong direction? But, you know, I mean, after all, it was a terribly distressing thing. But they were all taken back in an ambulance to Myrtle Beach and recovered. And then an alternative occasion was set up in New York. So now we get down to the actual incident. But I want to point out to you just once more, and forgive me for doing it. It's the way my mind works. You know, superficially, on the surface of this story, here is Stevens going through all of his gyrations and mental cogitations, and is it this or is it that, and I don't feel comfortable about that, and so on. And it's a pretty self-centered, egoistic story from that standpoint. This is the way we think. This is the way we live. We live inside of our own shells. But I realize now the careful, challenging, providing of information, providing of living experience, bringing up to date, unsorting of knots from one's own internal experience that the avatar led me through. So the scene is not of Stevens trying to think through his things, but really Baba knowing exactly who I am, what are the important hang-ups that I've got, working out the learning experiences so I can get ready, get to the point where instead of coming before him with a whole barb of bristly antagonisms, that at least I can meet him neutrally. This is what he had done to me in 7 years. I'm ashamed to say it took that long, of course, but it did. So, New York. Well, he was going to be there over the weekend and for 1 or 2 days after that. So I went into my boss, and he knew me modestly well. I don't think there were more than 2 or 3 people in all of Standard Oil of California who knew I was a Sufi. Nobody knew that there was anybody called Mayor Baba from India involved in the whole thing. But 1 or 2 of them did, and I said to my boss, I'd like to have the weekend and probably the first part of Monday to go out and see this person who is the head of our order now. And he was very cooperative. You know, really, you'd be sort of surprised about how elastic and human some of these moguls can be. At any rate, he was very cooperative, and I got on the plane on a late Friday afternoon. This was still in the old propeller days. We sat down in Chicago overnight, and I got into New York early on the Sunday morning. Baba was in Mercer Deduce's home Saturday to receive people there. I tried to do a little shaving with my electric razor over in a friend's apartment. Went over, buzzed on the door just off of Central Park West, where the Deuces lived at that point. And Charmian Deuce, Mercer Deduce's daughter, came to the door and were old friends and greeted me warmly. And, said, well, Don, there are 3-4 people before you, but would you like to go up to my bedroom and just sit quietly? And I saw that in the living room, in the salon, which is a lovely big 2-story, rather imposing reception room, there are quite a few people milling around. Oh, I'm not a terribly shy person and not especially super sensitive, and normally I enjoy being around chattering with people, but to my amazement, I appreciated Charmy's sensitivity, and to my surprise, I thought, yeah, it'd be sort of nice to be a little quiet before going in to meet Mayor Baba. So I trundled up the stairs and went into the bedroom, and there were a couple of gals there that I knew, and they were sitting over by the window. And when I went in, instead of coming over and greeting and chitter-chattering, they just said, hi, Don, and they went on chatting, and I sat down on the edge of the bed and waiting for this event. 7 years waiting on it. As I sat there, and I guess feeling a bit dopey after being on the plane overnight, and I wasn't especially thinking about Baba, to tell you the truth. We had had some pretty tough personnel problems in the laboratory, and I was wondering how under the sun either to fire this guy without getting in a mess, or to avoid firing him and to avoid the messes that I knew would still keep cropping up. And all of a sudden, I felt sort of strange in the throat. Oh, my God, I picked up a bug on that darn plane. There must have been somebody in the plane who had a cold, and it's passed around to me. You know. And so a little worrying about that, and I went back thinking about this personnel problem, and all of a sudden I thought, gee whiz, my throat really feels very, very tight. And then the whole thing began to pile up on me. For some strange reason or another, this began to transfer up into my sinuses, and my eyes began to water, and I thought, for pity's sake, what's going on? I think I'm going to cry. And, you know, I wasn't upset about anything. I wasn't thinking about Baba. All of a sudden, I remembered a story that it very often happened that when people first met Baba, all of a sudden they broke down and cried uncontrollably. It just suddenly flipped back in my mind, this story, which I thought was sort of a sentimental old wives' tale. Forgive me for using these terms. I hope they don't shock you, you know. I just have to talk honestly with you about how I felt and the things that went through my mind. I felt things like that were, you know, a little bit loony, over-sentimental. But here, suddenly, this remembrance of this effect, and I thought, well, but this is impossible. I haven't even been thinking about it. I haven't even been in front of him. It can't have anything to do with that. And then all of a sudden, I thought, my God, I'm going to start bursting out weeping. And what are those two girls going to think over there that I know? And what sort of stories are they going to tell? You see, old Stevens' ego here, wondering what the effect is going to be when all of a sudden... Here's a guy who's supposed to be a scientist working in a research laboratory in a petroleum company, sitting on the edge of a bed, and doing nothing, and all of a sudden he starts crying. Wouldn't that be a ridiculous story? Well, I was so embarrassed with the thought of it, you know, that I looked over to see if they were looking at me. I did a little bit of wiping of one or two tears away, you know, and thought, my God, this is going to be the scandal that's going to really flip me. Did my very best, and I got a little under control, and I thought, well, I'm going to make it after all. And about then, one of the girls looked over and smiled and then went back talking. And all of a sudden, it hit me about twice as hard, and I thought, God, I'm really going to burst out. You know, and my chest started to heave, and really, you cannot imagine the extraordinariness of a sense like that when nothing like that has ever... I'm a double Capricorn. You don't do those sort of things. So at any rate, by some miracle, the second great crisis was passed, and just about that point, why Charmy opens the door and says, Don, Bob is ready to receive you. Followed her down the stairs, and still feeling absolutely so disoriented and ashamed and mortified at this unexpected emotion surging up, that I followed her down, and my mind was just sort of seething around up here. I wasn't even thinking of Baba at that point, but what a crazy thing to happen. So she went through the living and over to where a double door going into a little library was, and opened the door, and I went. There was a chaise longue. Remember, Baba had broken his leg in the accident in Oklahoma. His leg was still in the cast. It was propped up. Can't remember. I think it was the left. I think that was the way it was worked out. And he was stripped to the waist, had on a very light sadra, which was folded down, and a bucket of ice, a tub of ice with a fan in back of it. And in back of the fan, funny little gentleman with a red hat, who turned out later to be Gustaji, who had also taken the vow of silence years before, smiling away and smiling, you know. Baba sitting there, and three other Indian gentlemen surrounding him, or should deduce, I think one other Westerner, can't remember who it was. Baba looks at me and smiles, and then immediately beckons, and two of the Indians come to him, and he stands up. It's absolutely crucified me to see Baba with his broken leg go through the gentleness of standing up. I mean, it just absolutely broke my heart. With a broken leg, who was I, for heaven's sake, to command this sort of gentleness? I mean, way beyond anything which we would do in Western circles. I started to protest, but before I could protest, Baba smiles and props his cast leg on the floor and starts gesticulating. And who was it? I don't know. Couldn't have been Gustaji, could it? He was in a vow of silence to one of them. I think it was Adi Sr., who was the interpreter at that point. And so Adi Sr. Reads out the first words that Bob is saying to me. What does he say? You know, my first name is Don, D-O-N. And so Baba says, ah, so this is Don. We have been together since the dawn of time. Well, double take on that one, you know. I mean, how touching to have been with this great individual all of that length of time. Gee, I'm pretty good stuff to be around such an individual over that long a period. But my other reaction was, gee, that was a pretty corny pun that he pulled on me. So it was my first little introduction to Baba's sense of humor. I don't think he ever pulled another pun on me, though. And I didn't know what to say back. What do you say if somebody says we've been together since the dawn of time? Well, gee, weren't those apes lovely in those times? Or what did you think of the mastodons or something of that sort? You know, but it was so. I never got over being dumb around him. Every time he would say something sweetly or humorously or gently to me, and I would search through all the crannies of my mind to try to think of something hopefully amusing or maybe just slightly intelligent to say back. I'd just sit there like that, you know. Poor old Bobby, he'd always have to bear the brunt of all of the conversation that went back and forth. So on about... Really, it was about 5-10 minutes that this went on, and I can't tell you what all went on. I do know what went on inside of myself, because when I did leave, I realized a couple of terribly important things, crystal clear, and the most important things that have ever happened to me. First thing I realized, and there was no question at all about it, and it was easy, and that was that in all of my experience of being around human beings in all of my life, and I feel a number of extraordinary human beings, none had come within even a tiny anthill of measuring the height of this individual, of his inner being, of his development. No question. An instant recognition. You say, well, how could you know that without sitting and chatting with him for 2 or 3 months? You don't ask yourself a question like that. You just know. His quality was so instantly manifest and apparent. The other thing that was equally apparent and of extraordinary importance, and this is one of the functions of the avatar, I'm sure, in our lives, and that was to know that he knew me totally. I didn't feel that I was naked or transparent. Simply, totally known to another individual, and the incredible part, totally, totally accepted by that individual. Not with sort of, well, you're sort of a naughty boy, sort of tolerance at all. Not at all. Absolutely 100% accepted in every atom and every item and every detail. And you know, when you're around an individual of that caliber and you find that sort of acceptance, it makes you ashamed of your own shame of yourself, your own unwillingness to be, to accept, and to go on in your own life. An extraordinary, necessary thing, I think. Immediately, those two things were established. And I was absolutely so floored by them that I couldn't concentrate on what poor Adi Sr. was translating in the way of gestures. I feel ashamed of myself not to have preserved this for posterity, the first great meeting, except for that pun line. But those were the two important things that happened in that first interview. Well, after that, then, finally, Baba, with his very nice deftness, and sometimes he's more direct, you know, sometimes he can give you a poke in the ribs to let you know when it's time that things have gone. But in his nice, gentle, deft, diplomatic fashion, then it became evident that it was time for me to get on and for somebody else to leave. And so Baba said, well, now, Don, we have met each other, and of course we'll be seeing each other in Harman tomorrow morning to talk about Sufi affairs. And I sort of came back to life and concentrated on the immediate and began backing out of the door. And I don't know what sort of imbecilic mutterings I may have made at that point, but I backed out of the door of the study, and there he was, and Gustaji still smiling in back of the ice bucket and the fan, pushing away on a little bit of cool air on that hot August sultry day in New York. Well, I went back out into the salon in a complete state of bedazed befuddlement, and so I don't know, was it Charmy, was it somebody else said, well, Don, now we'll make arrangements to go up together to Harman. I said, well, do you mind if I just sit here for a while? No problem. So I went over and sat underneath the window on a bench some way, somehow. And I was getting close to lunchtime. Around lunchtime, I wandered out, and I think I had a sandwich somewhere. It sort of vaguely registers. Then I wandered back in, and people were streaming in and out, meeting Baba for the first time, and I just sat there. A lovely thing, you know, once in a while somebody would come by and say, hello, how are you? And then they would go on. Nobody tried to strike up a nice, pleasant, polite conversation. Oh, you're out from San Francisco, and so on. I just sat there, and about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all of a sudden, study doors open, Phyllis Frederick comes out and says, Baba's going to tell a story. Ah, absolutely wonderful. So here I was going to get to see Baba already, and I just suddenly realized that obviously that's why I'd been sitting there. Of course, it might be a possibility to see him again. I didn't even know that I had a desire to see him again at that point. You know, just instinct was taking over. There might have been 10, 15 of us in the living room at that point. Here's Baba, still on his chaise longue, pointed over roughly towards the windows over there, and Gustaji with his little red hat and the ice bucket and still smiling and so on. So Baba indicates that we're to sit around him in a semicircle. Well, actually, I'm a bit shy. I'm less shy now than I used to be, but in those days I was modestly shy. So I didn't want to put myself right in front of Baba. I thought that'd be presumptuous, even though we had been together since the dawn of time. So I put myself rather up in back of him. In fact, when he was looking at the beginning of the circle, I was absolutely, totally behind his head. Baba begins to gesticulate, and I've had two or three people repeat to me the story that he told, and I can't remember it to this day. I can't tell you the story that Baba tells. Mercy de Deuce gives it in How a Master Works, so if you want to read it there, but don't ask me for it. So here I was, sitting back here in back of Baba, and watching the gestures. Well, I've been around really some of the world's great storytellers in my time, and I know their techniques, and I know how they capture an audience. And to see the fashion in which Baba absolutely, totally gathered the attention of those people, fascinated them, the beauty of his gestures. Yes, someone was translating his gestures, but it was the grace and the manner, the delicacy of the telling of the story which created the entire atmosphere. Superb. And here I was, and Baba gesturing and turning his head, this magnificent manner, he'd catch this person's eye and catch that person's eye, you know, all of these beautiful little manners of making you feel the directness of his relationship with you. Incredible. You know the master is working when you see this sort of thing. And all of a sudden, involuntarily, I started to raise my hand with my fingers in this position, signifying the circle of perfection. And just as I started involuntarily, without thinking, it was so beautiful and so perfect and so complete. As I started to do this, Baba in his gestures leans around and he interrupts his gestures, telling the story in a very graceful fashion, to repeat the gesture to me. Well, I thought, oh, how lovely, how charming, just like a symphony, you know, flowing out. Well, Baba goes on telling the story, and suddenly I thought, well, that's a little strange. Very, very good timing that just as I start to raise my fingers in the circle of perfection, that he turns around and catches it out of the corner of his eye, because remember, I'm about 120 degrees off of his direct vision. So, you know, it wasn't just automatic and natural. It was a nice little coincidence. What's that beautiful phrase that Elizabeth patterns? A little Baba happening, I think is the way she would put it. A little Baba happening. But then here was I'd been a graduate in chemistry and a minor in mathematics, and I'd been fascinated by mathematical probability. And just some odd months before, I'd done a whole series of very erudite thought concentration experiments based on mathematical probability and had some absolutely god-awful, earth-shaking results from that, you know. So mathematical probability, for all of these reasons and associated with avataric happenings, was right fresh in front of me. And gee whiz, I was really curious. I'm going to see whether that was quite the coincidence that it looked like it was. So, you know, I buttoned myself up intellectually, and I decided, well, I'm going to try this one again and see what he does. Isn't this awful, treating the avatar that way? But, you know, this is so typical of how we go about these things. But anyway, that's how I went about it, so here we are. So I decided this time when Baba was looking way over at the far end of the crescent semicircle around him, I'd catch him real good this time. And so he was looking way over there, practically out towards Central Park area, if you could have seen it through the window there. And directly off, I was right in back of his head, you know, right here. And so as he was looking directly there, I bring up my hand again, and rather quickly he turns right around, does the same circle of perfection back again. So I thought, well, you know, mathematical probability, there's no way he had to have eyes in the back of his head to do something like that, obviously. So that was absolutely charming. So then I watched his. I was so happy to see that I had proven my little mathematical experiment to myself and had shown that this is one of the powers that he had. I watched him as he continued on his little story. And at the end of it, everybody, you know, happy and smiling, and Baba, that was a wonderful story. And we went out, and I decided, well, I'm still going to stay on. It was getting late in the afternoon. Along comes 5, maybe 5:30, and almost everybody is gone. Door opens. I believe it was Sarosh then is wheeling Baba out.